Welcome, everyone, to the Goldster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all characters and styles and their enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their dreams, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're exploring writing fiction. Please enjoy, and to find out more, check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. And without further ado, let us begin. Hello and welcome to Goldster Inside Story, where we are going to the exotic delights, the oriental intrigue and the political upheaval of Asia, that wonderful sprawling continent that takes us from the mountains of Japan to the palaces of India, where religions, culinary delight, cloths and fashion, dances and martial arts moves, and thousands of languages live cheek by jowl with each other. Now, my erudite and thoughtful guest today, who you will see waiting patiently beside me, is steeped in Asia, indeed from Japan to India and much in between. He has written a brilliant fictional account of the partition of India, leading to the independence of India and Pakistan and then Bangladesh, ethnic killings and numerous wars. In India Be Damned, he takes us into the fictional minds of characters living through the last stage of the Raj. Journalists, politicians, influencers, although they didn't have them in those days, lovers and freedom fighters. India Be Damned is a captivating read. Lord Mountbatten, his socialite wife, Edwina, the rush to decolonize, damning India to a baptism of blood. How we Brits love India, he muses, but what sort of country is India really? We're going to find out. We have so much also to find out in the coming hour because my guest was a longtime foreign correspondent for The Independent and has written books on Japan and Myanmar or Burma. Ask him anything you want because that is a Goldster rule and he will try to answer. And welcome Peter Popham to Goldster Inside Story.
Hello, Humphrey. Very nice to be with you today.
Wonderful. Where are you, Peter? Are you in Asia or are you in Europe?
I'm in deepest Camden in London NW1, about a short distance from Regent's Park, but in the middle of an extremely mixed community, substantially Bangladeshi, which makes me feel pretty much in Asia still.
So you feel at home now. You've lived and breathed Asia for years. I mentioned culinary there. Just to ground us in that, what is your favorite Asian dish? Is it Kashmiri chicken or Japanese sushi?
My favorite dish at the moment is something I discovered quite recently. You get pressure cooked short grain brown rice.
Right.
And on top of it, when it's still hot, you add this wonderful fermented soybeans you can buy in Japan, but nowadays you can also buy in Chinese supermarkets called natto.
Okay.
And you mix the natto with fiery Korean pickle, kimchi.
Right.
And you dump it on top of your hot brown rice. It takes about 5 minutes and I recommend it highly.
So this is a great description. Is this a Korean dish or an Indian dish or what is it?
It's a Japano-Korean fusion dish. It's the way to go for those two countries so closely related but with such a long-term dysfunctional relationship.
I'm going to call it a Peter Popham Japano-Korean fusion dish. But you, how long were you based in Tokyo for, Peter?
I was there for a long time. I was there for 11 years.
Oh my goodness.
Arriving as a callow youth when I was a mere 25 and leaving while Emperor Hirohito was on his deathbed 11 years later.
And just ground us in that era. Was this the time that we were suddenly discovering that Harley Davidson and motorbikes were out and Honda motorbikes were in?
Yeah, you've got it. It was the biggest decade in Japan's modern history. It was the 1980s when suddenly everybody woke up to the fact that Japan was basically putting their industries out of business and selling us all hi-fis and motorbikes and everything else. And I was in Tokyo teaching English originally, and everybody wanted to know, you know, what makes Japan tick? Who are these people? How can they do it? How come they can produce cars which don't break down every 25 miles? And speaking Japanese, as I learned to do, I was in a good position to talk about it with a little bit of authority.
And it was as if there was a sudden push, wasn't it? And everything we had was suddenly made in Japan. And it did push our car industry and everything out. And then you went from Tokyo there to Delhi, did you, after that?
Well, I was freelance in Tokyo, but on the back of, I wrote a book there called Tokyo, the City at the End of the World, which was basically about how the world's biggest and most extraordinary city worked or didn't work, and why it was in some ways a thing of beauty. And on the back of that, I managed to get a job at the Independent newspaper, which was still in its infancy and flourishing, as a roving foreign correspondent for the Independent Saturday magazine. And subsequently, they appointed me their South Asia bureau chief. And so I spent several years in India.
I see. So where did you, before we go to India, and we go to, you've got India be damned, haven't you? Just show us the cover.
That's it, yeah.
Yes.
You'll see it back to front, I guess.
And that's what we're going to discuss at length, because it's about the partition, which is grisly, although all your characters are not grisly. But let's just ground in Asia a bit, because as I said in our introduction, this isn't like Europe. It doesn't have a sort of predominant religion and race and cohesion, and that it's all these different cultures and values jostling together, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, I think the my reaction to Tokyo when I first arrived, age 25, is actually it's the correct reaction for a European arriving almost anywhere in Asia, because it completely blows your expectations away. I've always thought India was a terrible place to go as a tourist, because it's too much, it's too extreme in every possible way. And that applies to everywhere in Asia, really. Everyone from the, you know, ludicrous skyscrapers of Kuala Lumpur to the teeming slums of Dhaka. The insane traffic just about everywhere in Tokyo, where the city goes on to the horizon and beyond. I think Asia is a constant shock to our tidy European minds.
What shocked you most, in a nutshell, when you first arrived in Japan as a callow youth, and then when you first arrived in Delhi? Just give us a vignette of your shock.
In Tokyo, it was the fact there were skyscrapers everywhere, despite the fact that it's the most seismically active place in the world. And I've been in a Tokyo skyscraper more than once during a very significant earthquake. And it's a sign of their extraordinary confidence in their engineering skills and their planning abilities, that they can build buildings this big, which will rock back and forth. And yet, because it's Japan, you know you're okay. So that's kind of like, for me, a quintessential Japanese feeling, is to be feeling
okay, to be secure, is it?
And yeah, exactly. Yeah,
safe. And when you got to India, a less callow youth, I presume, after your 11 years in Turkey, what was your shock element there?
Well, I suppose essentially that it was just so, I mean, it had absolutely nothing in common with Japan at all. I mean, it's Asia, but it's Asia exactly as different from Japan as you can possibly imagine, where practically nothing seems to work, where it's insanely hot, and yet which it is the cradle of Asian religion, which you mentioned. I mean, in the 5th century AD, it was Indian architects who were building Japanese Buddhist temples. In fact, the oldest building in Japan was built in Nara, the old capital of Japan, by Indian architects and designers. So the connection is umbilical.
Yes, this is very interesting. So you have this sort of wash of culture and influence, religion, going through the continent, but each of those countries keeps its very separate identity, doesn't it? There's no, you know, there's no sort of forging of cohesion like we have in Europe.
No, and even when they try with things like ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, it's a bit fragile. You feel it's kind of temporary, and it's also doesn't amount to a great deal So this is true. They've really, each of these countries, well, look at the hostility, which is still there essentially between China and Japan, despite the fact that China has learned so much about modernity from the Japanese, who went first in almost every respect.
And of course,
But of
as
course,
you mentioned, Japan and South Korea haven't forgiven each other for the Second World War, have they? Or the Pacific War, as they call it there.
yes, exactly. I mean, you're going from Japan to Korea. I mean, it's interesting for a Brit to go from Japan to Korea because you're very much going from this intensely insular culture to the continent. And it does remind anybody English of the experience of stepping ashore at Calais for the first time.
Ah,
And
interesting. Yeah.
it's not only the smell of garlic, but that was, that's the major part of it.
And I'm moving slowly to India, be damned. But firstly, we've discussed Asia, your own experience. The European colonizers left their marks on Asia. Just go through the sort of mark that they left, what they did, and how that feeds into the current Asian mindset.
Well, that's an incredibly difficult question, Humphrey. I mean,
But
it's
you're a
very early in the
Golster people, it
day.
has to be difficult.
I mean, the thing about Japan, which is has in common with Thailand a bit, but certainly Japan is quintessentially the country that was not colonized, and that had not been invaded at all. The kamikaze, the divine wind, kept Genghis Khan at bay. It kept the Mongols at bay. And so I guess what one experiences in Japan is how a culture grows up without those particular dominant influences coming from us in Europe. So it's very different being in Japan to being in any country, I would say, any country in the world which has had the heavy hand of the European colonizers making its unmistakable mark on the history.
So the only other country that I think wasn't colonized completely was Thailand, wasn't it? And it sort of let various invaders back and forth, but
Yes,
kept itself intact.
that's right. I mean, the thing. I mean, Japan, like Britain, is a chain of islands. And I mean, I think the surrounding sea, particularly in Japan's case, because it's twice the distance from Japan to the mainland as it is from Dover to Calais. So it's kept them. I mean, it's got pluses and minuses. It's got the minus, which is that. They tend to be shy, they can be mistaken as haughty. It's very, 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 very self-referential in a way that after 11 years can get tiresome.
Yes, and I
But
mean, you mentioned that, but isn't it the case though that Japan signed trade deals? They had sort of American gunships outside their ports, and they decided to cut a deal, and then they became American in a way, didn't they? And they studied the American way, and then that's how they became the most powerful army in Asia.
Well, I mean, they cherry-picked from all of the colonizing powers. I mean, America was certainly the black ships of Commodore Perry were sitting off Yokohama and saying, not really giving them a choice in the matter. And so once they decided, the Meiji Restoration decided that they really had to embrace modernization, otherwise they'd go the way of China. They would be colonized. It was a very clear and a rather brilliant prescience there in Japan about what they needed to do to keep intact. Then they cherry-picked quite with extraordinary discrimination the education system from here, the constitution from there, railways from England, school uniforms from Prussia, this, that, and the other thing. And so that by the beginning of the 20th century, when a period of a few years, England and Japan had a strong alliance, and you had this 1906, which was a terrific wake-up call for Europe as to
Yes.
what was happening in on that remote side of the world.
Yes, I think you might have broken up there for some of our viewers there. 1906 was the Port Arthur battle, I think you're talking about, where they defeated the Russian Russian army. So it was an Asian army defeating a European army. So you described that beautifully, vividly. How did the way that India or Britain handle its colonization differ from that? And what happened in India?
Well, in India, I mean, the thing about India is that the Brits were in India for such a long time. If you compare India and Burma, it's interesting because Burma's experience of the imperial powers is really very recent compared to India. India, Calcutta was essentially an Anglo city. They were established on the coast of Gujarat even before that. And you feel that for better or worse, the kind of that influence has sunk quite deep into Indian culture. So living there as a British correspondent was a wonderful experience. It was much more stimulating and welcoming and exciting than I'd really expected. I found the Indians were terrific company, incredibly interested in the world, very well informed, and it's got all sorts of problems, but it's a great place.
And so that was a completely different experience to your Japanese experience. But we're going back some years, but when you were there, when issues like the Indian Mutiny, which they now call their first war of independence, were they discussed at all in any sort of way how was that discussed then?
I guess my strongest shock in India on arriving was, I mean, I was sent there in 1997 to write about the 50th anniversary of India's independence, India and Pakistan's independence. And I discovered that every Indian I spoke to was much more exercised about partition. Because while independence was taken for granted, partition was still, it was a sort of scar on the history of the subcontinent, on the life of the subcontinent, which really it was still hurting. You still find so many signs of it in people's family histories, in the geography of Delhi. People say, well, that colony, Golf Links, which is a Tony sort of colony, that was established by wealthy refugees after partition. Khan Market, that's looks like a refugee colony still, and it was founded by Punjabi refugees coming over. There's a sense that, and of course, the endless tension between India and Pakistan, which is essentially the aftermath of partition. So it was, I was startled to discover that this awful experience at the beginning of their independent history was still there as a very present kind of anxiety and problem reality.
And still there today, isn't it? Because essentially the India-Pakistan border that goes down the whole of Asia in a way, if that was open, you could drive from, Bangkok to Paris.
Yes.
You've got Afghanistan and Iran in the way now, but technically you would have, but it's not, it's a closed border essentially, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, one used to have to fly from Amritsar to Lahore. There was a famous moment, which I actually reported, when the Indian Prime Minister went to Pakistan by bus. It was his bus diplomacy, because it's a short bus ride from one part of Punjab to the other. But of course, you can't go by bus today. It's not a regular service.
Yes, it's. I remember going several times to the Wagga border, where you get, if you've got a truckload of fruit, some people carry it on their heads to a white line and then have to pass it on to other people who carry it on their heads back again. So you've got no real trade there. Ground us in why the partition happened and why was it so violent?
It's the reason it happened is because, as I'm sure you know, the largest majority in the subcontinent during the Raj was a Muslim minority, which today constitutes the 200 million people in India alone. And there was tension between Hindus and Muslims, And it was exacerbated by British policies from the early years of the 20th century, particularly when Lord Curzon as Viceroy divided Bengal into West Bengal and East Bengal, with essentially the East Bengal being the substantially Muslim part and West Bengal being Hindu. And as the prospect of independence approached, then the anxiety of the Muslim community about what their fate would be if they ended up under Hindu rule, under Hindu Raj, kind of increased. And it became a very potent magnetizing influence, in polarizing influence in the politics, so that while Mahatma Gandhi attracted incredible numbers of previously apolitical Hindus, many of them very poor, to India Congress Party, Muhammad Ali Jinnah was able to bring a lot of very anxious Muslims into support of the Muslim League because they felt under siege from the Hindus. So basically, this was something which had been, it had been there for a long time, and it got steadily worse and more definitive as independence approached. And then the second question you asked was why it was so violent. And unfortunately, this is very clearly Britain's fault. Britain was very keen to get out of India as quickly as possible in 1947. But they did it with, under Mountbatten as Viceroy, they did it with such indecent haste, basically in the space of about 2 months, that it was impossible for it not to have been a violent event. And particularly because the British army was basically, the Indian army rather, which was still under British officers, played a negligible role in keeping the communities apart. So it's a tragic, but also to some extent a shameful story.
I mean, when you said that, it crossed my mind that even today, in the wars that, or the conflicts that both of us have covered in our careers, there's this sort of rush from faraway capitals to leave. So there was the rush to leave Afghanistan, there was the rush to get out of Iraq most recently, and you're talking about the rush to get out of India. Could it have been peaceful? Could there have been a partition without the bloodshed?
I think it could have been an awful lot less bloody. I mean, if it's correct that around 1 million people were made homeless, 1 million people died and 10 million lost their homes, it was bound to be a massive refugee event. But if it had been properly, if you'd had the military force which was available, which had been put in the right places with the intention of minimizing casualties, I think it could have been a much less tragic event. But as an expert put it in a recent book called Partition, a brilliant book, basically since the Indian Mutiny, the First War of Independence, the Indian Army's job was defined as protecting the white people, not protecting Indian communities from each other. Right. So the idea that they had a role to play in keeping the sides apart, this was never really accepted by the commanding officers.
Okay. And Sue Townley asked, and thank you, Sue, for correcting the times. I don't know how that went through. You said apparently one of our emails went out saying that this show was going to be at 6 p.m. and not 12. So sorry to those people that tune in at 6. but Sue also asked the same, explain why the rush? You know, why couldn't they have waited 2 or 3 years, or, you know, to sort of get things right?
Well, I think that, I mean, there's no doubt that Clement Attlee, as the UK Prime Minister, was very keen to sort out India, that the Labour government had absolutely no interest in hanging on to India a moment longer than strictly necessary. And Mountbatten was very keen to get back to his career in the Navy. And also he was very keen on his nephew, Philip, having a successful courtship with the Princess Elizabeth. So these kind of extraneous factors, which is very difficult to decide, you know, which was more important. But certainly there was no capital, no political capital for the British government in staying in India longer than strictly necessary. In fact, the only person who was opposed to a quick exit was Churchill, who basically opposed the idea of giving India independence at all.
So the whole thing, so if you're sitting around a, and we're going to the fictional world of this in a second, you're sitting around a cabinet table there, and Mountbatten says he's got to get you know, his Queen Elizabeth, Princess Elizabeth married off. Churchill says, well, we either hold it or whatever, and all these things. And somebody puts on an arm and says, yes, but if we do this now, there could be a million people dead. Nobody listens to that.
I don't think that anybody, either Nehru or the Indian National Congress generally, or Jinnah, imagined that the casualties would be that bad. It's one of those disasters which people really, despite the fact that you'd had appalling communal violence in the years leading up to it, you had tens of thousands killed, but somehow they rejected the idea that such a thing could happen. There was a kind of willed blindness to this. I think they were so keen to become independent, Britain was so keen to be rid of the whole issue, somehow the idea that the thing could be a ghastly tragedy was forgotten about.
Well, the reason I asked that question is if you could pick up your copy of India Be Damned and read, I guess yeah. It's the prologue or preface where you have an exchange from that great show, Yes Minister. You could read that to us and give us some perspective.
Okay. So, yeah, Sir Richard, who is the Foreign Office.
I think we've got a
Mandarin in the program, right? 20 years ago when we gave them independence.
Your line is breaking up. Is our audience hearing?
Can you hear me, Humphrey?
Peter breaking up as well.
Shall I try again?
Yeah, try again. Yes, please.
Of course, we made the real mistake 20 years ago when we gave them independence. Sir Humphrey says. Wasn't that right? Winds of change and all that? Yes, but not the way we did it. We should have partitioned the island. Sir Humphrey says, you mean like we did in India, Palestine, Cyprus and Ireland? Yes, says Sir Richard. That was our invariable practice when we gave independence to colonies. It always worked. Sir Humphrey, didn't partition always lead to civil war? It did in India, Palestine, Cyprus and Ireland. Sir Richard. Yes, but it kept them busy. Instead of fighting other people, they confined themselves to fighting each other.
Yes. Horribly, I shouldn't be chuckling, but horribly cynical. And you know, from the era that we've lived in, there is a shades of truth in that thing. Now tell us, India Be Damned, you have Zach, Fred, tell us your characters, tell us the story.
My characters, the main characters in my book were foreign correspondents covering the independent process from Delhi, as I was covering the celebrations of independence 50 years later. Fred Niblett, who is my hero, had gone out to India as a missionary, as a Christian missionary, but had been seduced by Mahatma Gandhi into becoming a disciple of Gandhi's, which he did for a while, in the process having a crush on Gandhi's female English assistant, Hilda, but then had got fed up with the restrictions of life in Gandhi's ashram and had become a journalist and was now working as the freelance correspondent of the Times of London, based in Delhi. A very important job at that moment. And he's joined in Delhi by a young chancellor called Zachary Starr, fresh out of London and unbeknownst to Fred, also signed up to report, do intelligence work for British intelligence. And Zachary essentially, it turns out, is after Fred's job. So as well as the historical move towards independence, you've got the tension between these two British hacks. And the third major character is an American journalist who has been traumatized by, first of all, by fighting in the Far East, in the Pacific theater, and then by covering the liberation of the concentration camps in Germany, and finally the aftermath of the Hiroshima bomb. And so he is, Joe Fisher is a kind of troubled soul who is so pleased to find himself in lovely exotic India and has a very passionate affair with an Indian lady. So those are the three main stories.
And do they meet Edwina Mountbatten and Lord Mountbatten and Nehru and the players?
They meet. Well, Gandhi appears on the very first page of the novel because Fred and Zachary, who are in a train going to Calcutta, see Gandhi sitting on the station platform. And Zachary, who's a much sharper journalist than Fred, manages to get into the carriage, which is carrying Gandhi onto his next stop in Calcutta, and tries to obtain an interview. So Gandhi and Zach we meet, and later on, Zachary also has a close encounter with both Edwina and with Mountbatten. So the big actors actually in the story, not Nehru and not Jinnah actually, but Mountbatten and Gandhi are big characters in the story, but they're acting true to the historical record. I haven't mucked about with what they did or said.
Right. And the be damned bit, that comes after partition. Where do you take us to through the book? Where does it begins and then where does it end?
Well, basically, Fred ends up in Kashmir for reasons which are a little too complicated to explain in a hurry. But he ends up in Kashmir living in a houseboat. And if anybody's been to Kashmir on Dal Lake, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. The lake's gorgeous. It's got the Himalayas, snow-peaked Himalayas behind it. The climate is exquisite. And it's also, in a way, the quintessence of the partition problem, because the Maharaja of Kashmir could not decide whether to go to India, to go to Pakistan, or to declare independence for his own state. And so Kashmir was actually the crucible of the first Indo-Pak war, and it's been a constant place of extreme tension for the last 30 or 40 years. So I was a lot of time in Kashmir as a correspondent, and it was that contrast between the exquisite beauty of the place and the terribly troubled politics, which was kind of very present in my mind when I was writing the book.
Well, it is present. I mean, when I was in India, you would go to Kashmir to cover protests and demonstrations, and
exactly.
Then as they go horse riding up the glades and stay in a houseboat or the hotels that are there. But just explain to us, what is the problem with Kashmir? I mean, where is it? Why has it become this flashpoint?
Well, the thing is that neither India nor Pakistan can afford to let Kashmir go its own way, because it is located so crucially. It's got a border with China, which is actually quite a hot border. It's got a border with Afghanistan, which was where the first war came from. So it is absolutely, from the point of view of Asian power politics, hanging on to Kashmir is essential. Neither country can afford to relinquish it.
And it's divided in two, isn't it? I mean, Pakistan runs one half of it and India runs the other.
Exactly. That's what happened as the aftermath of the first war there. I mean, the majority of the population in the Kashmir Valley is very largely Muslim. You have Buddhists in Ladakh in the northeast, and you have Hindus in the south in Jammu. So it's a real mess of a place from the point of view of its religious affinities,
I think it was 2019 or 2020, India changed its constitutional position, didn't it? It just became a normal state. It had no separate autonomy that it had before.
Exactly. The kind of the special relationship of India to the rest of the country was dissolved by Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister, in a crowd pleasing Hindu nationalist move, which did nothing to solve Kashmir's problem.
And I want to get back to India, but then we got waylaid into my curiosity on the non-fiction element. Sure. So I want to get back to the fiction. You've given us the characters. What are the stakes for these characters? What propels the narrative of the book, given that we know the historical backdrop?
They don't know what's coming. I mean, they are there to do a job of work. They're in a place, well, from the point of view of Joe Fisher, the American, this is a haven after the terrible places Germany and Japan and the Pacific Islands, where he's been before. Fred, at the beginning of the book, he's in the position of the kind of the entitled Englishman in the subcontinent, who, although he's intensely liberal and a former follower of Gandhi, basically feels terrifically at home in this multicultural stew where he enjoys the privileges which he completely takes for granted, the privileges of being part of the ruling race there. So in a way, the story of the book is the gradual shedding of illusions of all of these characters, Fred and Zach in particular. Zach is an intensely ambitious careerist who discovers that actually he's in the thick of something which is far more serious and dangerous than simply becoming a successful journalist. Fred discovers that his status as the entitled member of the ruling race is completely fragile and is breaking apart with the process of partition. So there's a gradual kind of disillusionment caused by the events leading to and beyond independence.
And they witness the raising of the flags and the declarations of independence, I think, as you and I have at various occasions around the world, where the sort of, as I say, the sentiment is all upbeat and optimistic. But this is a sort of midnight's children type of journalism. And did they know, was there disagreement between them? One was saying, yeah, this is absolutely fantastic. And the other one's saying, no, it's gonna end in hell.
Well, actually, what it was, I mean, basically we see this through the eyes of Joe, the American journalist who's working for Newsweek and is required to produce a bloody great read about the independence celebrations, all this razzmatazz, the whole spectacular display of independence, which of course was in fact a very happy day for India. I mean, this was before the bloodshed of partition. In Delhi, you had huge crowds on the street, and you had the small white population was embraced by the Indians. It was a huge sense of euphoria and hope in the air.
Tryst with destiny, wasn't it, that Nehru said in his speech?
Yes, he made this wonderful, brilliant speech, a tryst with destiny, and a hard-hitting speech. And I mean, after all, Nehru was an extraordinarily effective politician. But it's reported by Joe, but the tragedy for Joe Fisher, the American journalist, is that his lover has gone, and he was with her, into the Punjab with their Sikh driver, because the driver had to get home to his family, worried about whether his village would end up in Pakistan or in India.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
And so Joe has to leave his lover there in order to rush back to Delhi to report all this stuff, and completely ignorant of what fate is befalling this woman he loves passionately. And that's the, well, I'm not going to spoil it for anybody who cared to read it.
No this spoilers.
What happened subsequently is the kind of the you know, this really the most devastating event for poor Joe.
And the you mentioned something that you said that went back to see whether the, where the village would fall. Had nobody drawn a map?
Well,
that's told people where they would be living.
Well, Humphrey, this was the, you know, this was the kind of the perfidy of it, really, because you had this unfortunate British lawyer who had done this map, basically apportioning Muslim majority communities to Pakistan, Hindu majority ones or Sikh majority ones to India.
Yeah.
But the partition awards, as they were called, Radcliffe's decisions, village by village, were not published, were not made public until Britain had actually relinquished control, until after independence. The day after independence, that was when the awards, so-called, were published. And not until that moment. You'd had plenty of violence before with all the rumours circulating about what which community was going to end up where. But the actual knowledge that, oh, we're in Pakistan, Lahore is in Pakistan, definitively.
That was the day after independence. That was,
yeah,
published.
And that was lighting the blue touch paper, and the damn thing went off like a bomb.
And whose idea was that? Not to tell people in advance?
I suspect Mountbatten might have had something to do with it.
I mean, it's the crazy, but that bit from Yes Minister that you read as you say this, and of course I sort of knew these things, but you're putting it in perspective for it. I mean, we did a partition. We did that partition in Northern Ireland, which caught, you know, going right through different counties of that because of the Catholic Protestant
the divide. Demographic, yes, challenge and, there,
and,
yeah,
and the catastrophe, as the Palestinians call the creation of Israel, we allowed that to happen. It's, I don't know what to say. In fact I do know what to say, because Emma has asked, what message does your story tell regarding the partitioning of India?
It's a great tragedy, which these days, actually, we in Britain know more about it. When I went out there, I don't think anybody in Britain was really keenly aware of what it was all about. I wasn't, even though I was sent out there to report it. That's why it was such a shock to discover that's what Indians were still agonizing and talking and thinking and arguing about. I think it's just, you know, it's always very difficult and uncomfortable to look at elements in our own history of which we have every reason to feel ashamed. But I think it's, you know, like Germany had to be conscious of what had happened to it in the 30s and 40s, and we need to face these facts. It's the only way to be a grown up country.
And we haven't faced them yet. I think, is it Shashi Kapoor was one of the people that endorsed your book, and he wrote,
yeah.
Could you tell us that?
Well, it's, I mean, as I say, gradually the kind of awareness of what happened at partition is becoming clearer, but almost entirely due to the descendants of people who suffered from the partition who now live here, of whom Anita Anand, for example, yes, the journalist, and plenty, yes, of others who have actually said, you know, do you know what happened in 1947 in Punjab? I'll tell you what happened. Yes. So, you know, we here are gradually, and not necessarily with great enthusiasm, learning about these events.
Yes.
Shashi Tharoor, who has very kindly endorsed my book with a nice remark, which we put on the front, is, yeah, one of the most eloquent people who are talking about, you know, the long-term effect of British rule on India.
And he's advocating reparation, isn't he? He wants Britain to pay back for what it did.
Yeah, that's not something I've got a strong view on, really. How about you?
I was going to say that during that time that our audience, you might remember, I think 2 or 3 years ago, when they were pulling down statues, and there was a time around central London, they had to cover statues up. So they covered up Nelson Mandela, and they covered up Churchill, and they covered up Gandhi. And I was cycling around, and you have Nelson's column here, and you have two guys on horses either side of it. One is Napier, and the other one is Havelock. Each of those generals, or whatever they were at the time, were responsible for the Indian Mutiny, the first war of partition, of which I think the Indians say there was a million people killed as Britain put down the first rebellion for independence. Those statues were untouched because nobody knew who they were.
Right.
But actually, out of all of the people that were covered up, they probably had more blood on their hands.
Yes, quite possibly. Yes. Well, it's, you know, it's we've had a long, messy, and very interesting history, and I don't know about reparations. I mean, India is now it's substantially recovered from the effect of British rule, and indeed the fact that the English language is one of the residues of British rule is clearly a factor in the rise, for example, of South Asian politicians. The Prime Minister of the UK's South Asian heritage, the First Minister of Scotland, and the current Prime Minister of the Republic of Ireland, they're all South Asian heritage. So in a way, history has done its reparation job for them.
But how do you think it is going to unfold, Peter? Because it's not just India, although India's probably the biggest one with the partition. But there are the narrative of our rule, colonial rule, is coming out everywhere now, from slavery in the Caribbean to what happened in fact, Emma, thank you for this, Emma. Historically, was Britain the only Western power involved in partitioning countries? Because Rhodes did the same with Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Malawi. So we're in Africa now, the Caribbean, in South Asia. How is all this going to unfold over the next 10, 20 years?
I think that the fact that, you know, the historical seesaw has really moved, hasn't it, in the last 50, 60, 70 years. And it's clear that whatever was the dominant position of the European powers, we are really, in many respects, a cozy backwater these days. And the real engines of the economy are in Asia, in particular, and even the political players. I mean, it's becoming more and more difficult for the West to make a plausible and consistent position until Russia-Ukraine happened, when suddenly the rights and wrongs are startlingly clear in that particular case.
Yes, I mean, we're quite good at the very black and white, good versus evil, but we're not good at the sort of nuances. And Asia is a more nuanced continent, isn't it, than Europe?
I think we've made so many mistakes in Asia over the past 30 years. I mean, you look at the whole dreadful mess over Afghanistan and Iraq post 9/11. It's extremely difficult for any of the Western powers, including the United States, to do anything in that particular post-colonial world without blundering, actually, without doing things which then have to be undone a few years later.
Which brings me on to Sue Tanler's question, who she starts, I suppose people were coming to terms with the end of the war, but why don't we seem to learn from history?
I think we don't seem to learn from history because history is a tough teacher. It's a teacher whose lessons we really would rather do anything other than listen to. I remember reading about, going back to the question of Germany after World War II, and because the Allies were occupying Germany, the Americans insisted that before they watched a feature film in the cinema, the Germans had to watch an American-made documentary about the concentration camps.
Yes.
In other words, the German population had this rammed down their throats, and it was the last thing in the world they wanted. But if you went to the cinema, which was the only form of entertainment there was, you had to put up with it. And I think, you know, these are not lessons which are readily or agreeably learned.
It's very interesting because in Japan, which was also defeated and strike a nuclear attack, they have at the Yakusuni Shrine a war museum, which actually still glorifies the war. And you go into that shrine and you have the kamikaze warplanes, and you have the one of the steam engines that was on the Burma Railway, and which is completely against the narrative that we're taught.
Absolutely. And it's exactly the same thing, that human beings are the same in this respect everywhere. You find the same in Italy, where they're extremely reluctant to learn the hideous truth about what they did in Africa in Mussolini's day. The Japanese have been incredibly slow and reluctant to accept that they had guilt for what they did in the Nanking massacre in China in the 1930s. Yes. It's a universal fact, and it's something. But it's something I think, speaking as British, that it's long overdue that we were prepared to take these lessons.
Yes, I mean, in one conversation about India, an Indian that I was on a panel with said that the difference between India and, say, China and Russia is that it has never had this complete revolution where it's thrown out the old and bought in the new. It's still basically working on the on what Britain left them in 47, isn't it?
Well, yes.
The same railway system, the same postal system.
That's true. I mean, we were there. I mean, Britain was there for such a long time and basically established such a strong bureaucracy and a strong infrastructure that, yeah, it's still, I mean, it's a peculiar democracy. It's certainly the biggest in the world. And since Modi became prime minister, it's become an increasingly polarized and raucous democracy. But they still have an incredible election commission and regular elections, and so yeah, it's still on that path.
In a way, isn't what is unfolding now with Modi and the Hindu nationalism at the expense of the Muslim community exactly what the Muslim community feared when they were talking about independence?
Oh, that's a very good point. I think there's a lot of truth in that, and it's arguably. I mean. It's very unfortunate that Modi is such a successful and popular figure, because he really is a rabble-rousing nationalist, and he has had no compunction at all in whipping up antagonism to Islam and the Muslims. Yeah, so it's for anybody who loves India as I do, it's a tragedy that he became prime minister.
Now, when I was reading India Be Damned, I sort of thought, well, this is telling me or teaching me about India in a fictional way, like Graham Greene's The Quiet American was teaching me about Indochina and Vietnam at that stage. And in a way, Robert Ruark, when I was young, was teaching me about Africa. I don't know, Emma, if you know about Robert Ruark. But have you got another book that you're working on that sort of explains in fictional ways these big issues that we have been talking about, very big issues?
Well, I'm Humphrey. I'm incredibly flattered by those comparisons. I've idolized Graham Greene most of my life. I'm working on something at a very early stage, and actually, I'm bringing my attention back here, and I'm looking at the English Civil War, which was the cradle of an awful lot of stuff, whether it's colonization or slavery or the rise of the Puritans or the Enlightenment. Everything sort of came to focus in a period of about 30 or 40 years in the 17th century. So I find that I've got completely hooked on that period of time and this particular patch of soil, which of course is where I was brought up.
Yeah. I'm going to do a what if for you in the last minute or so we've got left here. But had we not bought back the monarchy after the Civil War, and we would not be having a coronation coming up next week, what sort of country would Britain be? I mean, what are the impacts of the Civil War and what unfolded there?
Well, I mean, yes, exactly. We've got another Charles,
You're absolutely right.
Right. No, I mean, well, one of the fascinating things is that, you know, Cromwell was such an effective general, having been completely self-trained, with no previous experience of if fighting of any description, and he just became this charismatic and brilliant and faultless general. But once he'd got ultimate power in London, he really didn't know what to do with it.
Yes.
I mean, he was completely flailing from the moment he became Lord Protector, and it was with a huge sigh of relief that that Charles II was welcomed back from Holland. So it's I guess it was, you know, the ideologies of republicanism had yet to crystallize, really. So that had to wait for the American experiment 100 years later.
Yes, and some countries need monarchies, don't they? And some are better off without them.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're fortunate to have the most environmentally and historically aware sovereign that England's, yes, had for quite a while, about to come to the throne. So yeah, I think it's
yes. And when we go through prime ministers every few months, like we've been doing here, you need somebody up the top, don't you? Peter, stay there for a moment. I've just got to tell, sure, our wonderful audience what's coming up. Tomorrow, by hair's breadth of a popular vote, our book of the month is French Kafka's Metamorphosis. That beat Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed. So we go for a very wide range of stuff here. And it's about a salesman who one day wakes up as a cockroach, and the family tensions that follow and what it means in the lives for all of us. That's going to be an open, unrecorded discussion, so we can all say what we want. May the 4th, Lucinda is with Lisa Edwards, Dark Horses Ride, One Woman's Journey into Midlife and the Menopause. And May the 5th, Lucinda is back with Barbara Black's Hotel London, How Victorian Commercial Hospitality Shaped a Nation and Its Stories. Looks at Victorian London's grand hotels as both an institution and a culture intimately connected to the urban landscape. May the 11th, I'm with Alan Bardos with his great First World War series, featuring a renegade, flawed and swashbuckling hero called Johnny Swift. And then on May 12th, I'm with Frances Evesham, who's a retired speech therapist, but who reinvented herself as a best-selling cozy crime author of the Exham on Sea and Ham Hill murder mysteries. That's all coming up now. Do you know Kafka, Peter?
I've read my Kafka, Humphrey. I'm a great fan of half Kafka.
But why are you a fan? I need your input for chairing our discussion tomorrow.
He's such a spooky writer, you know. I mean, he makes your skin crawl. I mean, certainly the Metamorphosis as being an excellent example of, I mean, just such a, I mean, he's born as a dung beetle. I mean, that's how, yes, it was in the translation, yes, I read. Yes.
And the sort of family tension, some of the family ignore him, the sister tries to fear, and then everybody sort of ignores him.
Yes, I mean, the trial, again, is a story which is everybody's nightmare. You're on trial, you don't know what for, and you don't know what's going to happen to you. It's a sense of being inside modern bureaucracies with no way out. Yes. And I think he has universal appeal.
And having lived in Japan, India, and Britain, which one is the most Kafkaesque, would you say?
Well, you didn't, the one you didn't mention, which is certainly Italy.
Right, okay, yes.
and in fact, Kafka spent years working for a huge insurance company which is based in Venice, and an awful lot of his literary experience is actually tapping his experience of working inside an Italian bureaucracy.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, our final question that comes to all our guests, because you look a little over 30, Peter, I've got to say, although very youthful, whatever it is. And at Goldster, we have tips. We ask our guests for tips of how to get the best out of later in life. What gets you out of bed in the morning? You're looking at a book on the Civil War. Despite the knocks and bumps we all get in life, what is your tip to keep us all going?
Zen meditation every day. Half an hour of Zen meditation is very good for the back, very good for the brain, emptying the brain of crap regularly, every day. It's as good as moving your bowels. And I guarantee you'll feel better after it than you felt when you started.
Zen meditation every day. We'll have to do that book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, wasn't it? It was a big one.
Why not?
In our day. That's it. Time's Wing Chariot is upon us and we have to prize ourselves away. What a beautiful conversation we have had about Asia, India, Japan, and the dreadful and great things that have happened. They're a fantastic show. Thank you, audience, for your comments and questions. Sorry to everybody that thought it was at 6 o'clock because of some bogus email and it was in fact at our usual time of midday. Until tomorrow, when we discuss Kafka's Metamorphosis, injected with some insight from the great Peter Popham. Stay active, stay curious, stay generous, stay involved, and of course, stay Goldster. Thank you, Peter Popham, for a gripping and fascinating conversation. India be damned. It's up there on the chat. Buy it and love it. Bye, Peter. That's it. India be damned.
Thanks very much, Humphrey. See you in Queensland. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. And find out our vast range on www.goldster.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Goldster does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Goldster.